I mean, it's also Chablis, so it's not like a perfect comparison, but
it does smell very ripe. It's just like, I think,
so
of
so ripe.
Ripe, ripe peaches.
Yeah.
Which I actually really like. It makes me very happy.
Oh, this is the medicine. Yeah. Oh my god.
It smells, to me, it smells like pineapple and like,
it's just lush.
Guava and
lush is such a lovely word for it, yeah.
It's like walking into a Tommy Bahama store.
Yeah.
almost just to the point
sold
of it being
to you as underripe.
A little overwhelming. It's like it's just on the verge of cloying.
Which is why it's so insane to me that people love new oak, like, and tons of it on Chardonnay, because Chardonnay from a really warm place like Napa is like already very opulent, and then you're gonna add like tons of new oak on top of that. It's like, man, that's overcome. A lot.
Yeah.
Like, it's a lot. But everyone has different preferences.
Also,
everyone,
like,
a different place.
I don't palette. Know. This is just my like personal observation. Like, the more bells and whistles you add when it comes to liquor, wine, spirits, mixology in general, the more aesthetically appealing it becomes, right? So to say that you've had an oaked Chardonnay inherently sounds fancier than to say you've had an unoaked Chardonnay, because it implies moreness, which sucks. I mean, there's nothing wrong with oak Chardonnays in general, but that presumption is flawed.
Well, now you see a lot of Burgundy producers who will say unoaked Chardonnay on their labels, which I think is like really silly, because you should just be buying Burgundy to drink the style of Burgundy.
Right.
Like, they've always used oak. So it's just about whether or not they keep the oak balanced and whether or not it, like, works and that's the style you want, right? So it's just, like, such a... It annoys me the most when I see, like, French Burgundy that says, like, un-oaked on it.
It,
like,
doesn't...
That's purely for an American market.
That's what I was going to say. It doesn't surprise me at all, though, because of the people that they're targeting, they don't care to... It's like, I don't... I actually sympathize with them.
I mean, I get it. From a marketing standpoint, you want to sell your products. So
it is a name, though.
It like, I think, trains people the wrong
way. Oh, that's an interesting point, right? Because
like
it just
trains the consumer.
It perpetuates that cycle. It really does.
Right.
Like, there's no... That's the only way that you've learned how to understand this. Keep understanding it that way. It's okay.
Exactly.
We'll flex around you.
Exactly.
Thank you for listening to Food and, the official podcast of the gastronomy program at Boston University. I'm your host, Amy Johnson, and I'm here with Altamash Gaziani.
Hey.
And Marie-Louise Friedland.
Hi.
We set up this podcast as more of a roundtable discussion for an upcoming event that we're hosting through the Diversity and Inclusion Office in partnership with the gastronomy program, called The Curse of Connoisseurship, Discussions of the Boston Beverage Scene. So this idea came about kind of spontaneously when we received an email or call for grant proposals from the Diversity and Inclusion Office. And I had always wanted to host a wine and spirits event that would discuss diversity and inclusivity and really kind of get at the heart at some of the things that we address in food studies that is very much lacking in beverage studies. And I think that we've also been quite frustrated with the way in which the beverage studies realm has been portrayed. So
I remember the moment when you actually, when I got the text from you saying, hey, this is an idea. I was sitting at my dining table eating pad thai and my mouth was like full of noodles, and that's when the text came through and I looked at it and I was like, oh god, a tangible way to make this work. Let's do it.
Right.
I love it.
The amount of times I've texted Altamash with the words, okay, so, and then launched into some idea about academia or what have you. So I wanted to find a way to bring beverage professionals into this conference to really give them a platform to educate other consumers, to educate businesses, and really tap into a market that has previously been muted. It definitely came from a frustration, you know, studying food through the gastronomy program and seeing all the really awesome things that people are working on, and then turning my sights to beverage studies and being like, there's not a whole lot here. There's a lot of scientific information, but I don't think there's a whole lot of political commentary, progressive commentary, forward-thinking commentary. So hopefully this will inspire people to do the same within their other communities as well, and really just be a good jumping off point to try to get us towards a more inclusive industry.
Yeah, I think that's the hope, right? Is that this is a springboard, because obviously this isn't going to be the end all be all. It's going to initiate a lot of what we envision to be difficult conversations to have. And that certainly doesn't mean that they end or stop when it's done.
Hit the nail on the head. But I would love to also give you both a chance to discuss your backgrounds in food and beverage and your take on the industry and how you arrived here today. Altomas, do you want to go first?
Shoot, let's do it. I started out in the hospitality industry as a line cook. And I believe my first job was when I was about 14 years old. I know that I'm meant to stay in this industry for a while. I derived a lot of pleasure from cooking. I went to culinary school, a good 4 years, devoted almost a decade of my life to practicing and perfecting that skill. I realized that for my own happiness and just in terms of where my passions lay, that I needed to make a shift from the back of house to the front of house, and found myself bartending in Boston when I moved into the city at a place called the Hawthorne in Kenmore Square, RIP. And when I got to the bar is when I really started asking questions again. I think culinary school answered so much for me in terms of food, but being in that space, which was so close to such a part of the hospitality industry, so close to what I was already doing, but at the same time such a new world, it sort of reignited my academic passions, which is how I found my way into the gastronomy degree. And I've graduated this past January, which is still weird. It's still strange.
It will never not be weird for me. And I just want to say Altomash is the reason that this girl likes gin, which I never thought was possible. He's a phenomenal bartender.
Can we not know?
Marie-Louise, can you tell us a little bit about how you got to where you are today?
Yeah, so I actually grew up in my grandparents' restaurant in San Antonio, and really got to experience what a family-run business full of love in the food industry could look like. My grandparents definitely set the bar really high for me, and even though I decided to go to college for advertising, I always ended up working in restaurants to kind of put myself through school. And once I graduated, I realized that my heart was really in the food industry and specifically in the beverage world. So I decided to pursue the route of being a sommelier. So I went through the Court of Master Sommeliers and got my certified sommelier certification. And I moved to San Francisco, worked as a wine director and sommelier in multiple restaurants there. I found my way back home to Texas, and I, you know, as I moved around, I kept asking questions, a lot like Altomash, and I kept trying to push the boundaries of the social responsibility of a restaurant to its clients and to its staff, and I was really annoying and probably took on a lot more roles than a sommelier would, but I really wanted to leave a lasting mark on the industry, and I was struggling to figure out how to do that at some point. Once COVID happened, I was already kind of putting out feelers for graduate school. I knew that I wanted to apply an academic approach to the mountains of what is it called, like professional work that I've done. Mm. I wanted to start looking at things a different way and find an outlet for all my questions. So once COVID happened and I really saw how it affected the restaurant industry, I knew that it was the perfect time to pivot. So I applied to the gastronomy program at BU, which I think has an incredible mix of both direct culinary and beverage experience, but also lots of really fun academic angles as well. Of course, still being the outspoken question asker, my professor Megan Elias said, "You need to meet Amy and Altomash." They are also obsessed with beverage. They're also obsessed with kind of the social awareness that is lacking in that industry. So she put us in touch. We had a really wonderfully drunk Zoom hangout because I was still in Atlanta at the time.
That was cute. I love that.
And yeah, now we're here and I'm going to be a panelist for the Curse of the Connoisseurship with a wonderful female sommelier named Liz Mitchell, who really helped me through sort of grappling with the harm and destruction that the Court of Master Sommeliers sort of placed in my path. So I'm really excited. I'm excited to have this conversation amongst us three and also then kind of elaborate more on that in the conference.
Yeah. Can I just say, if advocacy, the sort of advocacy that you're striving for is considered annoying, God, we need more annoying people in this world.
You're listening to Food And, a podcast from the gastronomy program at Boston University Metropolitan College.
Connect with new friends and get updates on new events and food studies by following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at gastronomy@BU.
I just want to say Marie Louise brought the funkiest, funnest, fantastic Chablis I think I've ever tasted. So I want to kind of launch into that. We each brought a producer that we are pretty excited about. So if you hear us refilling our glass at any point this evening, just know we're having a little libation here. So I want to kind of touch upon that.
It's completely professional, of course.
Right. Yeah. So Marie Louise, tell us about this Chablis.
Yeah, so something that I think is really important in the beverage industry is making sure that we are allowing people to step out of the boundaries of what is considered acceptable and normal in all facets. So that means distributors, importers, producers, sommeliers, bartenders. I really want to uphold, you know, outliers in every way, because the more outliers that we allow, the more diverse this industry is going to be.
Yeah.
So I have always kind of been into the super weird and the outliers and the rebels of the wine world. So I picked this wine up at Rebel Rebel in Somerville. And the winemaker, her name is Athenaeus Breu. Their estate is called Chateau de Breu. It's in Chablis. The property's been in the family, the same family, for 400 years, which is wild to me, because that is like crazy. As old as our country. And when her father started to reinvigorate the land in the 80s, he unfortunately had an untimely death. So she was actually not making wine. She decided to not be in the family business and was living in Paris and working in finance. And decided to come back and make wine. And she definitely does an incredible job of upholding the Chateau de Breu's reputation for making incredible Chablis. But after a couple of difficult vintages, she realized that she needed to kind of like go, okay, I want to make wine for myself and to sustain our estate year after year. After everything was converted to biodynamic farming and organic farming, the property itself is super clean. She decided to start doing some experimental projects. So this is Chablis, 100% Chardonnay. She decided to age it in amphora, so big clay pots that a lot of orange wine is made in. This does come out a lovely golden color. She really kind of did a little sticking it to the man because
we support that in
general. Yeah, right. Because the AOC laws, the regulating body, does not actually allow for amphora aging of Chardonnay to be called Chablis. So you can call it Chablis and then not put a vintage on it, or you can not call it Chablis and call it a Vin de France and put a vintage on it. Since her family history is so rooted in Chablis, she really wanted to make sure that that was on her label. So she gave up the vintage designation. But what I love is that we're seeing more young winemakers in France rebelling against the AOC system so that they can continue to make wines that are full of creativity, that are different, that are clean, that are, you know, more natural. And
just an interesting expression of the grape itself, which totally. I think is something that French vineyards are kind of held to such a high standard that they don't allow the plant to just be the plant, to just have its own personality and expression. I mean, I've tried your standard Chablis and I was so blown away by this one just because it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. Replicability seems like such a part of the game when it comes to French wines because they've got to consistently satisfy those standards. And this was, it didn't meet any of the parameters in my head. And I, like Amy said, it's just, it was wicked fun. It is such fun to keep tasting.
We all took a, you know, whiff of the glass and all of us were like, whoa. I mean, it's, like I said, it's funky, but it's got this fresh, almost like slightly dewy quality to it as well. I mean, it's, there's a lot of expression going on in the glass right now. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah. It's a barnyard in which a cow just pooped.
Yeah, but also, like, then you washed it off. And so it's, like, clean barnyard floor.
Fair.
No, right. But what I love about this is that she's not trying to make it weird for weird's sake. When you taste it, it's Chablis. I mean, it's got tons of minerality and tons of acidity, and you can taste the wine of the place still. Like, she didn't morph it into something that is unrecognizable just to be weird. She just genuinely wanted the opportunity to show a different expression of the vineyards that she has loved and has been in her family.
Right.
And I think that that's super, super important in the wine industry, is allowing for creativity, you know, within some boundaries. We don't want to, like,
reason.
We don't want to, like, make anyone, you know, sick or anything, but I love this wine, and I love Chablis. I'll never turn down, you know, a Ravenau or Dovisot, but I think that the more new creative people we can support, the better.
Love it.
So, Altamash, can you give us a backstory on the rum that you brought?
Yeah. So I ended up bringing Florida Cañas Cristalina rum. It's one of their workhorse rums. They use it a lot for cocktail making, and that's what it's promoted to be as such. I really, really enjoy it because I think it's got some really wonderful, smooth confectionery notes to it. I think it goes down extremely well. Florida Cañas in general is a company that I really respect because of what they stand for in the rum industry, which happens to be one that is quite nebulous. It is a Nicaraguan rum. They have their distillery at the base of the San Cristobal volcano, and the rum really benefits from how fertile the soil is, from the specific microclimate over there. One really important thing to note about this company is that, much like Marie-Louise's wine, this rum has stayed within the family that originated it for five generations. So it's been controlled and in the hands of the people that developed this mash bill, that developed this formula, and all of their employees that they employed at the beginning, they're actually really proud to say that they've been sustaining those families over all of this time. Florida Cañas was also one of the first rums to receive the Fair Trade Certification in 2018, which is not an easy thing to do when it comes to liquors, because there just is so much output that gets wasted and that pollutes this planet. But this is a company that uses all of their cane output to convert to energy to power their turbines, to keep their facilities running. And they also are really proud to say that they plant 50,000 trees annually for all of the rum it is that they make. So their output is really offset by all of the humanitarian and ecological work they do to maintain this planet. And I sort of brought this rum because I was interested in having a broader conversation on rum in general and the concept of terroir when it comes to this product. I think that this is a rum that actually really does taste of place. And if there is a spirit in general that you could pick that to which the term terroir can be applied in a tangible sense, it's rum. Because rum is a liquor that belongs to people of color, right? It has both joyous connotations, but also real violences that are really attached to it because it is a slave liquor, right? Caribbean rum specifically is just a really good exemplification of this point, because it was something that was created by slaves for, and is now something that white people, essentially white Americans, largely get to be arbiters of taste about. And I think that conversations about terroir when it comes to, in general, are slightly difficult because obviously we live in a world where the label, where the concept of terroir can be affixed onto a label and it can be used for capitalistic motives. But as I mentioned before, this tastes of people. And the common phrase that goes with rum in general in America is that rum has no rules because there exists very little legislation when it comes to rum distilling. I really believe that this is something that needs to be changed. It's difficult because the TTP definition of rum, I don't quote me on the exact wording, but it amounts to something of like, to be considered rum, a distilled spirit needs to essentially be made from sugarcane, 90%, and needs to taste of rum. That's all they say. That's the legal.
Which is nothing. I mean, you like wanna, putting the word of something in the definition for it.
It's right. Wild. You want to talk about something nebulous. I do want to take a moment to also plug in the book you really adore, which is Caribbean Rum, A Social and Economic History. That is a fascinating read on the history of rum. And when we say that it's a nebulous topic, that gives far more insight and a lot more appreciation to rum and what it stands for.
I agree. And I think I put that book in context with a book by Colleen Guy on champagne for our Introduction to Gastronomy class. And that book spoke a lot about terroir as a concept, and this book spoke a lot about rum and its specifically its colored and ethnic origins from an archaeological perspective. And I put those two books in conversation when I was in Cuisines and Cultures of New England to talk about the commodification of these specifically colored spirit. I think what makes it so difficult to give rum and by extension the people that distill rum agency is the fact that the countries in which this spirit originated don't have economic might. They don't have their definition of AOCs that France has, right? They don't have geographical boundaries within which they can sort of assert themselves. So while rum agricole is a completely different product from Jamaican rum in terms of how it tastes in the glass and in the mouth, under the TTP definition of rum, it's the same. It's made from cane or cane byproducts, and it tastes like rum. And I think this is a world and that really requires a lot of investigation, and there's a lot of conversations that need to specifically be had with these people from these disenfranchised countries that don't have enough economic power, and there's going to be a little extra work that's going to need to be done to give them that agency, because they're not going to get it as a result of the system. Mm-hmm. Regardless, I think this company is doing a really exemplary job at both staying accountable to this planet, accountable to the people that make this rum, and they're also making something that's really tasty. This rum's awesome in a lot of contexts.
It's so good.
I was shocked by how like expressive it was on the nose. Like it smells like something, and usually when I've sort of like been tasting spirits, you smell alcohol, right? There's no finesse to it. It's you're just kind of like, ooh, okay, that's whiskey. Oh, okay, that's rum. But this has like so much going on.
Yeah, this tries. It really does.
Thank you for listening to Food and, the official podcast of the gastronomy program at Boston University. I'm your host, Amy Johnson, and I'm here with Altamash Gaziani.
Hey.
And Marie-Louise Friedland.
Hi.
We set up this podcast as more of a roundtable discussion for an upcoming event that we're hosting through the Diversity and Inclusion Office in partnership with the gastronomy program called the Curse of Connoisseurship, Discussions of the Boston Beverage Scene.
You can learn more about our guests on our blog at sites.bu.edu/gastronomy.
Stay connected with us and learn more about upcoming events and food studies by following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at gastronomy@BU.
We've obviously spent some time talking about the different wines that we brought as well as the producers and the companies that they stand for. So one could probably say, and I've heard this before, that we might be a connoisseur of certain types of liquors.
Ooh,
and I
foreshadowing.
Yeah, I personally really hate the word connoisseur, so I want to take a moment. I mean, the conference's title is The Curse of Connoisseurship, which is something Altamash came up with, and I loved that title. So I want to take a moment between all of us to unpack the word connoisseur and really try to redefine it. And this came because I was reading The Taste of Place by Amy Trebek, where she does not use the word connoisseur, but instead uses the word discernment or discerning palate, which I think is far more of an approachable term. I mean, we all have good tastes and bad tastes. We all know what we do and do not like, right? We can all say we have a discerning palate in that regard. So I want to take a moment and kind of hash out between the two of you. How would you redefine the word connoisseur? How do you feel about the word connoisseur?
I think that you bring up a really good point about discernment. And ultimately, right, what we're talking about is our preferences. And it does bother me, the more I think about it, that we've sort of put a right or wrong answer on preferences. If you have the wrong preference, you're not a connoisseur. If you have the right preference, you are a connoisseur.
Right, because taste is so subjective.
Exactly,
in that sense.
Exactly. You know, and it can really be most seen in the beverage industry because you have, you know, beverage is not necessary, right? Alcohol is not necessary. And from the dawn of drinking alcohol, right, it's been done for enjoyment.
Ceremony.
And,
that's the word I always
ceremony,
think of.
For
ceremony,
for sure. And so by not really needing it, it was a luxury product, like mm-hmm. kind of from the get-go. And to place preferences, or to say that there are right or wrong preferences on something that is not necessary, to me, very much sets up this idea of connoisseurship being really kind of elitist and sort of
very elitist.
Yeah, immediately discriminatory. Because if you don't have the right preference and you're not a connoisseur, then what does that say about you? You're not allowed to be a part of that world.
And I even want to like zero in on that a little bit. It's like, because you're allowed to have preferences, but this idea of right and wrong is where I keep getting stuck. Right?
Totally.
Is there that we live in a world where obviously things are complicated by a price tag that hangs off of everything that is such a clear indicator of what is quote unquote right or wrong. But we live in a world where there are right and wrong choices when it comes to this, right? Because I am a little troubled by the existence of preferences in this space in general, but more troubled by the fact that if you don't have the vocabulary to talk about what you find or what is right or wrong, then you're kept outside. You're just mm-hmm. excluded from the conversation altogether because you don't know how to describe this technically, aesthetically correct thing to drink
right,
in this setting.
Right. And I think that also being called a connoisseur means that you have enabled this particular type of coding within yourself that you're saying you're able to distinguish taste, you're able to identify producers, you're able to identify varietals, you're able to identify different types of bourbons or whiskeys or rums. And there is a very elitist coding to that that people find so intimidating and so pretentious. And I think a big part of why I wanted to host this conference as well is that we're putting beverages on such a high pedestal for virtually no reason. And we need to remember that at the end of the day, these are agricultural products, first and foremost. So why is it that we put these products on such a high pedestal when they really don't always need to be? I mean, we can have an appreciation for them. We can have an appreciation for wine growers and how they respect the lands, as well as rum producers and how they treat their distributors and representatives and how it's a family business, but let's not make it pretentious or elitist.
I even have an answer to that question, because if the question is why is it that we do this, this is an answer that I find myself turning to pretty often these days, and it's because these products are set up to compete against each other, right? Yes, they're, of course, that's something I want to keep remembering, and as Amy so poignantly said, we need to keep reminding ourselves of this fact that they're agricultural, they're grounded in a way that we often forget in these social contexts, but they're also pitted against each other, mm-hmm. and the people that ultimately distill these, there's very, very few of them that aren't also considering the fact that they're going to go in a marketplace, right? And there's such a rise in terms of the number of different beverages, wines, rums, liquors, spirits that you have out there, that it almost inherently sets up this idea of connoisseurship, because when you have so many products in conversation with each other, it becomes so much easier for people to say, well, I tasted this and I tasted this, and the context in which I had this and everything else about this product B was so much better than product A.
So this is this is anecdote one of why the Court of Master Sommeliers sucks. And
keep it in mind, there'll be a lot of these.
But the first one is that once you get to a certain level, you need to be able to attribute a grading level to the wine. So you need to be able to call this wine a Premier Cru Chablis, a Grand Cru Chablis, a Village Level Chablis, you know, just a Chablis, or Petit Chablis, or same thing with Burgundy, or, you know, one of the last final conclusions you have to draw is quality. And for me, that always rubbed me the wrong way, because that immediately sets me out into the world to sell and talk to guests about beverages in a hierarchical way, which sets me up as a connoisseur, which immediately then sets me up as a snob, right? Like somebody who's like, well, since I know without even seeing the label that this wine is garbage, you know, then like, you're perpetuating this idea that people's preferences are right or wrong.
Yeah, right? And then,
or like, I'm a connoisseur, therefore I know what is bad.
And then there's an osmosis effect, because that doesn't just stick to you, that then leeches onto people.
Exactly.
Right? The common people absorb, and because it's human nature, right?
Right.
They want to look to connoisseurs at the end of the day.
Right, and then they look up to certain figures, and it leads into an interesting discussion of power dynamics and classism within the beverage industry, I think. So how prevalent do you think classism really is in the beverage industry? I mean, like, how does it lead to an imbalance in power dynamics?
So when we're talking about connoisseurship, right, I think we've all kind of danced around this topic already, that it does create class divides. And, you know, living in a capitalist society, you're going to market those goods based on those class divisions. It's like, unfortunately, how marketing has always sort of worked, because you want to sell your product to the right people. So how are you going to kind of look at who those people are? In beverage, it very often becomes about class, because there, you know, like Altamash said, there are price tags that are very apparent. And it becomes a very obvious monetary fixation. And, you know, what beverages people have access to is based on their income, for sure. Because, again, it's not a necessity. So if you are going to imbibe, it has to be sort of factored into your budget. And I think that we've just sort of encouraged the perpetuation of class divides. Right? Like, this wine costs this much, therefore I'm going to sell it to that person.
Right, right.
Or this wine costs this much, so I'm going to sell it to that person.
Yep.
And I have actually been told by bosses in the restaurant industry that I'm not selling enough wine. And when I finally kind of got into it, I was like, well, but I'm selling a lot of wine pairings, which technically, based on margins, make you more money. So what are you trying to say? Oh, that I'm not selling high-priced bottles to rich people. And for me, I was like, okay, so you're putting, now you're creating a power dynamic.
You're putting a dollar sign on right. the consumer, which exactly. leads you into very dangerous yeah. territory.
And I understand the argument that that's what it is to be a salesperson. I get that.
Yeah.
But I don't think that it needs to be about that. I think that you know, one of my big sticking points with selling wine is get the money conversation out of the way first. It's like, how much you want to spend? And don't ever upsell them.
Right.
Just don't.
Right.
I know that that's like an insane thing to think about. But if you don't upsell them, then you've taken this class power dynamic out, right?
Yeah. You're right. like, right.
I'm not here to get one over.
If I can say one thing to anyone listening to this podcast as a consumer, the best thing I've ever done is walk into a wine store and say what price I'm looking at.
Oh, yeah.
Under 15, always. Under 20, under 25, meeting the parents, under 50. You mm-hmm. know, don't be afraid to put a price tag on it, because this is what capitalism and elitism has led us to believe, that you have to spend money in order to get a good product.
Right.
And that's not true.
It's empowering too when you walk into those spaces and you assert yourself that way as a consumer, right? Mm-hmm. When you can confidently say, and it should be. Like I really agree. And I've done a really similar thing when I've sold cocktails or liquor to people in early releases. I've been upfront. These are the cost of these drinks. Like and here, let's, like you just said, Let's not have to worry about that when ultimately my job is to get you something that you like. Mm-hmm. I understand that you're operating within your own means as a shape by your own life, but you're here, I'm here. At the end of the day, I'm someone that, as naive as this may be, I believe in the spirit of hospitality. It's what energizes me about being in this business, is about making people happy. And if these are roadblocks that this system is set up for us to have to overcome, that's fine. We can do that expediently, and then we can get down to the actual stuff.
Thank you for listening to the Food And podcast. I am Professor Megan Elias. Visit our blog at sites.bu.edu/gastronomy. There you will find select readings and books recommended by our faculty from the gastronomy program at Boston University.
Connect with new friends and get updates on new events in food studies by following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at gastronomy@BU.
I think this brings up an interesting point with relation to classism, elitism, and the consumer. So I'm curious to know, who do you all believe are the ones that are kind of most affected by classism? And power dynamics, the ones that you obviously just discussed? And really, how does this perpetuate gatekeeping? That is a kind of key word I've been focusing on as we've gone into this conference, is the idea of gatekeeping. Who is keeping these people out of the circuit? Who is keeping them othered? Who is keeping them from really feeling accepted in this position? So I'll turn it over to both of you.
I think that, okay.
Loaded question for the evening.
It's a heavy one, just because and this sounds like such a cop-out answer, but I don't really think that there is one particular party that's responsible for keeping this sort of scaffolding intact. I think that everybody works across purposes, and people have a lot of motives to keep the system in place. I think that there are specific consumers of beverages that benefit greatly from this existing, because they get to live out their lives and they get to stay at the top, right? And if you dive into the industry, you find very similar looking people that also benefit a lot from these systems and from keeping this in place, right? And in relations to gatekeeping, I think a lot about power. I think that's the first thing that my mind sort of goes to, is where does power aggregate, in which bodies does it actually benefit the most? And the more I look around, the more I'm struck by how
alike those people all look. Because they really do.
Yeah, I'm just going to say it.
Yeah.
White men benefit from classism. Yeah. I mean, it's true. And power dynamics is true. It goes, like you were talking about, the whole history behind rum and a lot of spirits, to be quite honest, and winemaking, you know. I mean, Bordeaux and Burgundy benefit from the fact that the English loved their wines from the get-go. Yeah. And if it wasn't that, then it was the Russian czars loving champagne. I mean, it has always started at the top, and whether that's the top of the society or the top of the classism period, and who has occupied that position historically the longest,
right?
White men. And I think that it benefits the perpetuation of connoisseurship and classism divides, because if you can set up a system of gatekeeping, right, to keep people out from your knowledge or your product or your ability to teach or whatever, like you said, it keeps them in power.
Yeah.
So they're going to benefit from it.
And that's heartbreaking to me, because so one of the conversations I'm the most excited for that the curse of connoisseurship is going to look at is we're going to be talking with T-Flux, which is a they're such wonderful
they're
people.
They're wonderful people.
It's a consumer-driven collection of three Black women that are looking to empower the consumer when they walk into specifically wine places, but also the beverage industry at large. I remember when Amy and I were sort of chatting with them in preparation for The Curse of Connoisseurship, we were talking about tastings, right? And this idea of them walking into a wine store and sort of just saying, hey, we're looking for a wine that tastes like red drink. And I wasn't sure what that drink was, but if I was the wine store owner, I'd probably ask them to tell me more about where they're from and try to find something that fits them. But what most people end up doing is alienating them, right? Because that concept, that food way that they identify with, is not something that fits in with the zeitgeist. So why would we open that gate for you to come in when it is that the people that that have this power in place have no interest in spreading that or letting you feel empowered by acknowledging your food way?
And I think also something I learned from our discussion with T-Flux is the use of Black culture within some wine stores in order to make it more approachable, but at the same time it veers towards appropriation. And so you see some of these wine stores that have menus that are catered towards Black culture, or you know, play
music. That's like the biggest thing that you can think
right
of.
But then at the end of the day, don't support a lot of the Black consumers, or don't get behind a lot of the initiatives around Black Lives Matter. Mm-hmm. And so there is a definite power play there to say, we're going to borrow from Black culture, but we're not going to fully support.
Yeah. We're not going to address the inherent disparity that the existing platforms that keep you down and keep me up.
Right.
Right. We're going to make it seem like we're there with you, which is the definition of appropriation.
I mean, that was a really hard-hitting point for me, because I've definitely walked into a restaurant or especially a wine bar that geared towards the Black consumer. But if you look a bit closer, what are they doing to address the gatekeeping? What are they doing to address power dynamics or the voices that are so often muted or feel that they can't see themselves in this industry? And I think that's an awesome point.
And I think that, you know, just from personal experience, that when you create this gatekeeping, people will do almost anything to make it through the gate, right? To be on the other side, to break down that barrier,
yes.
Which goes back to power dynamics, because that is a very dangerous situation to be in, especially when alcohol is involved. It leads to people being taken advantage of in more ways than one. And again, that is exactly how they stay in power, right? Is to gaslight you or to put you in danger or to make you so desperate to be in that circle that they can control you. It's so much about letting go of like your individuality and your identity and your inhibitions. Yes. But also I think like you have to conform, right? And you have to like do away with what you identify as to make it through that gate. And to me, that's incredibly dangerous. Just like the wine that I brought from Ateneus, like we don't need to conform anymore. Like, that's over. Like, we need to understand that anyone can walk into a store, use whatever descriptors they want to use to get a product that they want to pay for and enjoy. And, like, that should just kind of be the end of it.
And don't be afraid to find your own equivalent to any sort of beverage that you would like. But I also want to take a moment to say, and to really stress the point that if you are interested in beverage studies and wine studies and bartending and anything related to that sector, dear God, please don't be afraid of our conversations that we've had during this podcast, because the point of this conference is to really make beverage studies more approachable and to allow people into these spaces that have previously been guarded. So I want to thank Altamash and Marie Louise for their insight into the industry. Honest, hard-hitting, necessary discussions about these issues. And to really wrap up this podcast, what do you hope attendees will get from the Curse of Connoisseurship conference?
I think I'm acutely aware that we're going to have a real mix of people in this audience from what I've gleaned so far. It's going to be industry professionals. It seems like there's going to be a lot of potential consumers of alcohol. So I think for the consumers, I would really hope that they walk away from these conversations as a whole, understanding that connoisseurship as a concept forces consumers to play a part when it comes to existing in these beverage spaces.
Yes.
And that, as we've already talked about, it is for certain people and for certain bodies, but if our goal is to have a table that can be populated with bodies that don't all hegemonically look the same, then that role is probably something that doesn't really need to be play acted. For the beverage professionals that are going to be in attendance at this, I would really hope that they walk away understanding the role that they play as cultural intermediaries, because I feel like that's something I've often struggled with, is this idea that I'm just a bartender. I don't really have agency. There's not much I can do as one person to fix things, to make things more inclusive. And I know that they're, especially in terms of younger wine professionals, liquor professionals, mixologists, there exist people like me. I hope that people walk away understanding that even in just reflecting these attitudes, those smaller changes, you have agency in your own way. You can fight back against the system that continuously places white patriarchy at the top.
Yeah, that's... I basically was going to say that I really hope that people walk away understanding that they can fight, you know, and it's hard and it takes a lot of energy, but there are new avenues opening up every day that will allow people to continue to educate themselves. I know that that's something that's super important to me, is that I hope that people will always find a way to educate themselves, and it doesn't need to look the traditional way. Don't get caught in the like gatekeeping of organizations that don't serve you, and don't get caught in a mentorship that doesn't serve you. And you can go to graduate school and you can learn on your own and you can learn from real life. And I hope that this type of conference can be replicated, because this is a way of learning that is really honest, and it is indicative of the people in this industry who actually believe in it and want to do good.
That's an awesome point to leave us off on. And I just want to thank Altamash and Marie Louise for joining me, not only for this episode of Food And, but also just in this conference. They've been great standbys as we really trudge on and build this conference. It's amazing to see what just a simple idea has really transpired into. So thank you again for joining us. Signing off, I'm your moderator, Amy Johnson.